6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I'll just see how I'm doing now. As a starter, I wanted you to tell me how you first got interested in the NAACP, in civil rights movement.
Well, Reverend Dr. Warren, rather, I believe it goes back to a point before I could even, I guess, remember myself. One of the earliest experiences that I remember was the traumatic experience of being separated from a lad that I had known since birth when it came time to go to school. And we were living in the rural. I was born in this county. And his parents and my parents were the best of friends. And, of course, Randolph and I became inseparable. And to have to go to one school and he to another at the age of 6 or 7 was one of the early crises of my life, and I just never forgot about it.
This is a white boy, you mean?
Yes, Randolph was a white boy, and I understand from my mother and from his mother that as children, as babies, that they would leave him with my mother at times and me with him and his mother at times. And we both nursed each other's mother's breasts as children. And when it came time to go to school, we all looked forward to it. And here the great experience that we anticipated was so negated by the question of racial prejudice and racial bias that separated two kids who loved each other dearly. And since that time, and I can't remember a time that I was not concerned about the race question and determined to do what I could about it.
Of course, many people are aware of it. I suppose every Negro has to be aware of it a good part of the time. But the doing is another thing. I mean, actual moving into an organization like the NAACP or similar organizations, and you have been with it a long time, I understand.
Yes, I became a member of NAACP as the high school student when the senior class of 41 in Oklahoma County here were encouraged to take out membership in the NAACP. And of course, after high school, going into the service, there was an immediate need for NAACP philosophy with regard to the many instances of racial bigotry and racial prejudice we ran into in the service. And coming out of the service into college on the campus of Xavier University, there was a strong civil rights movement. Participating in the National Student Association as a student gave additional opportunity of participation with organizations that were concerned about the rights of mankind.
This is after the war.
This is after the war, yes, sir.
Yes.
And upon coming home from college in 50, we did not have an organized NAACP in the community. And in 52, we organized the NAACP here, and I became its president, and have remained the president of the local branch ever since.
I know you've been very prominent in it, in fact, so prominent that I've heard that the bullet that Edgar Evers got might have gotten you by Tulsa.
Well, I've heard that too, and we get it from what we consider usually reliable sources within the news media. But I'm not anxious to die, but I'm not afraid of it. I think one thing that the death of Medgar accomplished for me, it freed me from any fear of it. I know that I can never give any more to the cause than Medgar Evers gave, and he was the best friend I had, and I'm willing to give as much.
This was a deep personal friendship then.
Yes, sir. It goes back to around 50. We both got out of school around the same time.
Were you in school together?
No, we were school in different institutions, but
yes.
We came out and began working in the freedom movement together.
Was he a native Mississippian?
Yes, sir. He was from Newton County, Mississippi.
That's what I thought, but he was not from here. Though.
No, he was from Newton County, not from Goldwater.
Yes, I remember now.
Yes, sir.
There has been threatening, and there has been small acts of violence against you, hasn't there, here?
Well, yes, our house was bombed and set afire and shot into, and the store has been bombed.
The store's been, the windows knocked out too, hasn't it?
Yes, the windows are knocked out pretty frequently.
Pretty frequently, so I hear. Was it one case of shooting into the house or bore?
Two.
Two?
Yes, sir.
I read about one. I think I've heard about one more, well, another, but I didn't know. There might have been some I hadn't heard about.
Well, you see what happens. These things happen usually late at night. And some while, Corrine, of course, come through and they shoot at random. Mm-hmm. Perhaps not aiming, but just shooting a bullet could cause serious difficulty.
Well, you know, bombing isn't quite that casual, though.
No, the time that they bombed the house here, we were all asleep. And the concussion awoke us, and
yes,
of course the incendiary set the house afire, and we were able to get the fire out, however, before any serious damage was done to any of the people, any of the members of the family,
yes,
or any of the visitors who happened to have been here at that time.
Do you think that was just a bomb to frighten you, to intimidate you, or do you think it was meant to destroy the house?
I think it was meant to destroy us.
Strong enough for that?
Yes, sir.
What about the criticism of NAACP by some of the other organizations? Or people, put it this way, not organizations, as organizations. As I have encountered this here and there, you know the lines taken by various people, even...
Well, I take this position that it's important, really, that we keep our eyes on the target, which is freedom, and I guess also on the enemy, who would be considered those who are in opposition to all Americans, all citizens, obtaining citizenship in America. Now, I take this position also that in partisan conversation, there is bound to be at times a praising of a particular organization, and many times some people feel that the only way to praise their own is to down the other. In the main, however, I think that those of us who are genuinely concerned with civil rights, in speaking sometimes derogatorily about the NAACP, are not really serious in their criticisms. I think that to some degree, it's a kind of jealousy that some might hold because of the prominence that the NAACP has in the civil rights field. It might be that sometimes in our caution to try to be sure that the step we take is the right step to take, that sometimes we're criticized for moving slower than others would have us move. But when we look at the fact that regardless to who else gets in jail because of whatever activity they have become involved in, it's always the grand old good NAACP that, number one, puts up the bond money to get them out of jail, and number two, furnish the legal talents to get them out of the difficulty with which they're involved. So, although there might be criticisms leveled against the NAACP at times by some, I think that these criticisms are, in the main, expressions that do not come from the heart, but come from the lips in somewhat passion and are not really aimed at casting a derogatory picture of the NAACP, but are more to cast a pleasant picture about an organization for which a man might have a persuasion toward other than the NAACP.
Waving the question of one organization against another, there is an argument that one encounters to the effect that dependence on legal action, the insistence on the legality of the process, has inhibited the achievement of civil rights because it carries no threat with it.
Oh, no, no. I can't agree with that at all. I think that the mere fact that the NAACP has been involved in legal action, it has served as an apparatus to determine actually what the law is, what the law says, and a determination and an interpretation of the law that is on the book, without which there would be no precedent, without which there would be no direct action, knowing previously what the final legal outcome is going to be. Now, I don't mind violating many of the Mississippi statutes, but those that I violate, I know are in contrast with what is the law on the federal level. And speaking from a scriptorial point of view, I would not want to become involved in violation of the laws of this state that would be upheld by the Constitution of the United States. And I think that the legalistic approach the NAACP has taken has clarified this for us. Therefore, we can, without hesitation, become involved in direct action because we know the First Amendment to the Constitution gives us the right to protest. But the good old NAACP has established this right in our own minds. And consequently, when we violate this law, we're not violating what we consider an actual law, but a practice that's within Mississippi that we want to get rid of.
I've heard it argued, too, that the legalistic approach keeps the image of a law-abiding society. That's what will come out of the period of protest.
Well, and I think that's important. I think that we do want to become, we do want to be, rather, law-abiding citizens. And I also think that the legal image of this nation that has been identified by the work of NAACP lawyers and others really gives brings into the possibility of creation of the direct action movement. Now, were it not for the fact that the Constitution of the United States stands for the equality of mankind, so defined that this country itself was built on acts of protest, the Boston Tea Party and various other activities that of which were responsible for the birth of this nation, were not for the fact that we know that these are democratically sanctioned principles of protest. The image of this nation in the eyes of the Negroes, it's very necessary that we understand that this is the position, this is the official position of our country. Were it that the official position of our country was to deny the right to Negroes to be full and free citizens of this country, I doubt very seriously if the protests that we are waging on a nonviolent nature would be continued to be waged in this restrained, dignified manner, because without the hope, without the knowing that the United States sanctioned what we are doing, then we would be in open rebellion against the country. And therefore, the restraints that we are now able to impose upon those who participate, it would not be possible if the victories that we seek were not so assured.
Do you... First, let me read you two passages criticizing Martin Luther King's philosophy. May I read you this? It's by the passage by Kenneth Clark, the psychologist at CCNY. Here's the quotation. On the surface, King's philosophy appears to reflect health and stability. While the black nationalists, he'd been talking about the black Muslims, betray pathology and instability. A deep analysis, however, might reveal that there is also an unrealistic, if not pathological, bias in King's doctrine the natural reaction to injustice and oppression is bitterness and resentment. The form which such bitterness takes need not be overtly violent, but the effect on the human spirit remains the same. It would seem, therefore, that any demand that the victims of oppression be required to love those who oppress them places an additional and probably intolerable burden upon these victims. In other words, the notion that it is psychologically unhealthy to forgive. Now, in the light of your own experience, which is vast in this matter, and your observations and readings about the effect of Dr. King's program, what would you say about this?
Well,
this comment.
Dr. King's philosophy is built on an understanding of Christianity, the Christian ethic. I certainly agree that the adoption or the following through on an ethic of Christianity is not, shall we say, common sense. It's not a kind of reaction that one would normally be expected to understand.
It's not common human nature either.
No, Christianity is not common human nature.
It's redeemed human nature, is that it?
Yes, redeemed. And it's only in this context that I think that Dr. King's philosophy, and which is the philosophy of many of the others of us, that Jesus Christ so forgave his oppressors, and if we are to be true followers of Christianity, then we too must be able to forgive those that oppress us. But I also think that King is very careful in identifying what he calls love. He refers to the Greek language in an identification of this love. And the three words that the Greek use, number one is phileo, which is a reciprocal kind of love. One who is loved because he is loved. And it's certainly not love on the phileo level that King espouses, that we love our oppressors. The other word, another word that the Greeks use is the word called eros, which in Greek understanding is the yearn of the flesh for the rim of the garment. An aesthetic, syncopating kind of sexual attraction, man for woman. And it is not in this context that King is talking about either. But the third word that the Greeks use is the word called phileo. And when we arise to love, the third word that he uses is the word called agape, excuse me. And when we arise to love on the agape level, we love men not because we like them, not because they like us, not because there's something physically attractive about them, but we love them because God loves them, because the Redeemer of this world that we know about caused them to be created, and we know that he loves everything he created. Therefore, it is up to us to imitate the leader of the Christian faith, as hard as it might be, and as difficult as it might be. We know that freedom is not easy, that without some suffering there will be no freedom. And I'll go along with King all the way in this redemptive kind of love that espouses a love of mankind because God himself made him and he loves him.
I've heard certain admirers of Dr. King say that only by this is there a basis for a future society, that you could win every lawsuit, by force seize every right, if necessary, by force, and then have no society when you got through, without this human recognition across the lines of race.
Well, that's probably true on the American scene. I think this. I think that there has to be this contrast of activity with the emergence to freedom for Negroes in America. I don't think that we can win our freedom by using the same apparatuses that are used in that have been used in Asia and Africa, in Ghana, in Nigeria, in other countries of Africa. When the Negro has emerged to freedom, he has driven out the white oppressor, and the land has been left to the blacks. But here in America, when we gain the freedoms that we know we're going to get, our white brother and our black brother are going to be still right here. Neither is going to drive each other out. Therefore, there has to be this symbiotic kind of response and respect one for the other.
That is, this is not a nationalistic revolution, except in the black Muslims' dreams. It is a matter of a social adjustment within the same nation, within the same...
I say that we've got to learn to adjust socially to all other people in this country and not accept differences as any connotation of superiority or of inferiority, merely a cultural difference.
That brings up another question, which I... I encountered it first in reading Du Bois many years ago. Mm-hmm. He speaks of the split or the division in the Negro psyche. He says, on one hand, there is the yearning that at least some, perhaps many Negroes feel, and he was one of them, for identification with the black soul, with even with the spirit of Africa, Mother Africa, or some pull toward the exclusive experience of being Negro, what is now the negritude or the black mystique, those phrases. On the other hand, there's the pull, as he puts it, toward the Western cultural tradition, Europe and America, and the impulse to enter that tradition, to integrate with that tradition, and perhaps in the end, to lose Negro identity entirely in entering the bloodstream and the cultural stream of the Western world. For some people, this is apparently a problem, a real division of loyalty. Do you think about that, or does it seem significant to you? I know to some people it's not significant at all.
Well, it's not significant from the standpoint of what will the outcome be. I take the position that as an American...
I'm sorry, sir, I've got caught on the tape problem here, but...